Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Pain is something that is treated medically, for example, with drugs. It's treated psychologically, socio-therapeutically, and I would like to walk through all these aspects because it's a neat walk to what is central to both medicine and the Christian faith, pain. Usually we avoid, or we are being asked about the topic of pain, like as if we would have to excuse for there being pain out there. But that is perhaps not the way to approach the topic of pain. I'll start a bit lightheartedly. This is obviously a hot source, 100%. If you want to begin a bit more slowly, you might want to buy 85% pain, and it's all capsaicin, hot pepper sauces, which some people like to add to their food, especially people in, for example, China. This is a picture from a Christian Chinese university where I spent only 2 months teaching and other things. And I'm using these pictures to tell you about a little clinical study on a lighthearted introduction. But it also helps to introduce the word tachyphylaxis, or how one gets used to almost everything. Tachyphylaxis means that you take a drug, you shouldn't read further on. That takes away the fun. Tachyphylaxis means that you take a drug, and after a while, the effect will wane. So you have to take more, and this goes on. And this is also the case with hot pepper sauce. It was an experiment which we embarked many years ago. We embarked on it, a small group of volunteers, 4 people. The study design was fairly simple. Go to a Chinese restaurant, order and add spice for hotness, eat the stuff, do this 1 to 3 times per week, gradually increase the quantity of the hot drug. And the starting point was that we jointly consumed about 1/10 of one of these small jars which sat on the table per meal. And our end point was, that is how far we got, that we asked for a second jar and jointly consumed 1.5 jars of this hot drug per meal. We reached this after 4 weeks. So this is an example of how you can overcome pain by inflicting pain. Actually, the problem that forced us to end the study was, and I hope this is something I can address before lunch, the mucosa at the beginning of the alimentary tract acquires tolerance much faster than the mucosa at its end. The interesting thing about this, a bit more scientifically speaking, is that you inflict pain to stop pain. Or in pharmaceutical terms, you induce the development of tolerance on the molecular level. So pain against pain. That's an interesting, it's actually a research subject, because one of the big problems in pain treatment is neuronal pain, neuropathic pain, which is a tautology, but that is how it's sometimes called, neuropathic pain. And people are actually trying to stop this neuropathic pain by giving something like capsaicin, which is the hot principle in hot peppers. Because the capsaicin receptors are not pain receptors, and that is also a very important point I'll make in a few slides later, but they're heat receptors. So the receptors that capsaicin stimulates are also stimulated by degrees of 43 centigrades and above. It's actually a heat. You experience heat, not pain, when you eat capsaicin. But for some reason, excessive heat is interpreted as pain. People have done that with rats. They have given a comparatively large amount of capsaicin to rats intraperitoneally, and they had to artificially breathe the rats, because otherwise they would have died, because this shock of hotness made the rats something like stop breathing and functioning at all. So they were artificially sustained for about 15 minutes, And after that, for 2 or 3 days, I can't remember exactly how long, and I didn't look it up, for 2 or 3 days, the rat were almost pain insensitive after that. It's not something you could do on human volunteers, even if people suffer from pain so badly that they would accept almost any treatment. Pain is a hot topic, pun intended, at least in Germany. These are just two recent books, fairly popular books, very good books actually, on pain. The Pain is the Disease, How I Learned to Live with My Headaches. Pain, a History, a Story of Liberation. Both books sell very well and they're really good, 2016, 2015, new books, and we have a lot of literature in standard journals on pain. It's a really important subject, pain, how to treat it, how to get rid of pain that plagues you for weeks, months, or years. What is pain? This is an official definition. There's an International Association for the Study of Pain. I wonder who is a member. I'm not. Maybe all readers of, what's this series called? Gray, these strange books called Gray, maybe these people are members. Pain is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or described in terms of such damage. That's interesting. Unpleasant. Hard to define that scientifically. Emotional. Also hard to define that scientifically. Experience. Oh, a lot of subjectivity comes in. Or described in terms of such language. So language plays a big role in the definition of pain. You cannot measure language on an instrument. Still, language is, of course, a very important means for us humans to ascertain something, to learn something, and to talk about truth. Types of pain. There are different differentiations. One of them, which I've included in this talk, is pathophysiological types of pain. There is something called nociceptive pain. Nociception, in case you haven't come across this term, is derived from a Greek root meaning damage and perception. So nociceptive pain is you feel there is damage. You find out there is damage somewhere and this is interpreted as pain. Another medical term for another type of pain is inflammatory pain. Inflammation is not pain as such, but it triggers prolonged stimulation of nociceptors, sensibilization of afferent neurons and the spinal cord, and that leads to a decreased pain threshold and hyperalgesia. So if you have a small inflammation, for example, in the finger, even a slight pressure on the finger might inflict a lot of pain, whereas the healthy finger, you could just do this and I don't feel a lot. Neuropathic pain means that there, for some reason, constantly pulses are generated by afferent nerves that lead into the central nervous system. For example, after injuries or with shingles, or there are lots of other medical issues where you have the problem of neuropathic pain. And there is functional pain, which is caused by the abnormal processing of pain stimuli. Physiological causes usually untraceable, and that's where people have to look for other sources, definitely, or additional sources of how to tackle pain, other sources than medicine. This is types of pain. Well, I don't want to dwell on the medical aspects or pharmaceutical aspects any longer at the moment. I'll get back to analgesic substances for one or two slides, but presently I would like to continue by not talking about pain in, let's say, medical terms, but a bit more like philosophical terms. Of course, I'm stepping out of where I feel comfortable, but this is what I think I need to do. Pain models. The pain model at the time of rationalism has long been overcome. Rationalism wasn't isn't the end of the scientific story. René Descartes, in his treatise on man, wrote the following, and I'll have a few long quotations in my talk. And my wife actually has done printouts, so you can take this home if you like, if there is a reference which you'd like to use in yourself in the future. Descartes' pain model was unidirectional. Unidirectional, nociceptive, stimulants, reaction, effect, like as if you pull a bell line and the bell rings. In his own words, in an English translation, thus, for example, if fire is near foot, the tiny parts of this fire, which, as you know, move very rapidly, have sufficient force to move with them the area of skin that they touch, and in this way they pull the tiny fiber, which you see attached to it, and simultaneously open the entrance to the pore located opposite the point where this fiber terminates. Just as when you pull on one end of a cord, you cause a bell hanging at the other end to ring at the same time. That's the unidirectional model, which is no longer the state of the art, because pain is not unidirectional. If you would define pain in this way, you couldn't explain phantom pain, where people have lost a limb but feel pain in the limb. You couldn't explain temporary painlessness, analgesia, of many very seriously injured people, even if this painlessness lasts for only a few minutes. And you can't explain the very different perception of pain of similarly injured people. So there must be something in between. Something in between. And a better, a more modern pain model looks like this. This is Descartes, actually a drawing Descartes made, or the person he was helped with in putting his book together. I've left the red line, which is the nociceptive stimulus. But this nociceptive stimulus is a sort of qualified. It's qualified by kind of descending response. And this descending response is also transferred through peripheral and central nerves. It is modified, this green line modifies how strongly and in what way the nociceptive stimulus reaches the brain. Pain experience is presently thought to occur in the brain, but there are genetic factors, neurochemical and structural changes, especially if pain has been persistent for a long time. Mood plays a great role. If you are happy, pain doesn't feel that bad. Attention and expectation could lead to a strong feeling of pain, even if there is just small damage done. Prior experiences, you expect a lot of pain. And all this modulates the nociception of pain. So in a very simple way, sometimes people say that there are no pain signals, but nociceptors, the red line, which send electrical and chemical signs, and this is somehow felt as pain or interpreted as pain, but it's modulated a lot. The modern pain model would consider pain as the integration of course, organic factors, which sometimes can be defined only with great difficulty. And that's the medical problem, the problem cases where people have pain, but you can't find an organ or a material correlate. There are psychic factors, and we'll come to that in a moment, and there are social factors, and all of this, person as such, and its interaction with her life and her surroundings, define pain or the perception of pain. The simplest way of going about pain is, of course, to kill it with painkillers. This is not a very good painkiller. This one is morphine. You have recognized the chemical formula, of course, before looking at the name, I hope. I'm afraid I cannot continue with chemistry, which I would like to do, of course. This is a fairly strong painkiller, except if it's for inflammatory pain. Morphine doesn't work well if inflammation causes the pain. This is a mild painkiller, acetaminophen, or it's called paracetamol in Europe, most European countries. This is not very strong. So this type of painkiller, what do they do? I don't want to give you a lecture on analgesics, which unfortunately we cannot do here, or maybe it's better we can't. But let me just ask very simply, how does the analgesic know where the pain sits? Laymen sometimes think that the analgesic somehow goes to where the pain sits and alleviates it, kills it, neutralizes it or something. Of course, the analgesic doesn't know, or we would have to redefine our understanding of nature quite a bit. So what the analgesic does, like any drug substance, it distributes in the body according to its physicochemical properties. It doesn't go where the pain sits, it goes where physical chemistry and the pH value, lipophilicity, hydrophilicity of body tissues sort of lead us. And then it interferes if it can, if it finds its target, interferes with certain biochemical processes. The biochemical processes are not shown as such in this graphical representation. This just shows that either intravenously or transdermally or subcutaneously, subcutaneously or intramuscularly, you see the syringe, painkillers are administered. They can also be administered through the mouth, orally. And what happens is that the drug substance enters the stomach. It's not taken up in the stomach. Drug substances are not taken up by the stomach, but by the small intestine just after the stomach. And then they have to be distributed across the body after they've been taken up by the bloodstream, and they will be distributed and hit some kind of target. That's what all drug substances do. Intervention levels for analgesic drugs and analgesic medical treatments are the following. We can sort of stop the pain at different levels of its perception. We could, for example, start at the brain and give a painkiller, which will lead to the blocking of certain receptors in the brain, biochemical units, opioid receptors, for example, that are obviously somehow to do with the perception of pain. Because if you block them, people will not feel pain. Some partly because they get drowsy. Every sedative is also a painkiller, because when you're sedated, you don't feel everything, including pain, as acutely as you do without a sedative. So, or you could do acupuncture. You could administer drug substances near a plexus, which is an agglomerate of nerves, and through that stop the transmission of the perception through a nerve. This is all different levels, and they all deal with biochemical aspects. They deal with biochemical aspects of transmission, nervous transmission, synaptical transmission, chemical transmission, so to speak, of signals. Not necessarily pain signals, but you block signals, and ultimately the person will not feel the pain as acutely, or it will be completely gone, something like that. So that's analgesic pain treatment, and of course I've treated it only very, very briefly, which I think is sufficient in the context of this talk. Drugs, physiotherapy, surgery, which I won't talk about, are all physical means of interfering with perception that is ultimately interpreted as pain. Psychotherapy and social therapy also play a large role, and I've categorized this as mental approaches to treating pain or coping with pain, because perhaps it won't go away completely. You have to somehow integrate it into your life. I will repeat definitions of pain during my talk whenever a new sort of approach comes up. The state of the art discussion says that pain is emotion and specific sensory perception. And that is taking it much farther than Descartes did. Of course, Descartes is a long time ago, but I think in some people's minds, his pain model is still very active. Pain as a sensory perception is induced by sensory activation of specific peripheral and central neurons. The signals of these neurons, however, do not go straight to the CNS, central nervous system, or someplace, but the signal which my hand would feel if I would inflict, if I would damage the tissue here, the signal is split on its way to the central nervous system and it's filtered. A lot of filter functions are active in the spinal cord and also in the brain. And this leads to this feedback, which was the green line in the figure which I showed a few slides ago. If pain is felt for a while, or I should perhaps better say, if these signals are transmitted for a longer time, for example, because an inflammation just doesn't go away for weeks and weeks, the neuronal systems that deal with the transfer of the signal are remodeled. So, with all this, it means that pain includes some kind of integration, as I've repeatedly said, an integration of emotion, of specific and intensive signals, and of data processing. And please remember, even though I've just touched on this very lightly, there are no pain receptors. There are receptors, tissue, little bits of tissue in our skin, in our soft tissue, somewhere else in our body, that notice pressure, heat, damage, or something. But they are not actually pain receptors. You cannot, for example, put pain in there and it is felt as pain. You can damage the tissue and then somehow the result will be, oh, this hurts. But physiologically speaking, there is nothing like 100% pain. I couldn't have a bottle full with pain. The bottle is filled with an extract from capsicum frutescens, containing a very hot chemical, but I can't put pain in a bottle. That's different. Still, pain is very real. So there's this integration. The problem, of course, is, and now I'm not doing this in a rigorous philosophical fashion because I couldn't. I just suggest that there is something like a person, subject, certainly a patient that presents to the doctor with a consciousness that would say, I feel pain. So, and this leads me to the painful reality of subjectivity and consciousness, as I've put it here. And instead of trying to dabble around with philosophy myself, I thought I better include a quotation by Robert Spermann, a Catholic philosopher who's very well known in Germany, and I think he's really, really good. This guy is really, his books are really, really helpful, at least to me. And in an article on reality as anthropomorphism, he wrote the following. The fact that I'm in pain, only I can know with absolute certainty. But that does not mean that it is only true for me. If someone were to say, I experience yourself differently than you experience yourself, for me, you have no pain. I would answer him, it is not important how you or anyone else experiences myself or which scientific statements someone makes about me. The truth about my pain, only I do know. This, my subjectivity, is an objective reality, and that is what we mean when we talk of a person. And that's an interesting definition of person to me. A person is an objective reality that is the yardstick of any true judgment. I think this reflects back to some aspects of both Angus and René's talks. This is what pain means. You cannot measure it, but it's real. It's real because there's a person that tells you, I feel pain. Otherwise, it would sort of go away. And that's an interesting, it's medically, philosophically, and from the Christian standpoint of view, it's a very interesting phenomenon. Psychotherapeutically, pain is treated Well, I would say very, very simply, basically by making the person adjust mentally to, well, this won't go away for a while, perhaps never. How you do this mental adjustment? There are lots of possibilities, and they will certainly be governed by how you perceive yourself, how you perceive your eternal future, or whether you think there is none. All of this will have a strong, strong impact of how psychotherapeutic pain treatment is sought and given. I find Viktor Frankl, the Jewish physician that survived the German concentration camps, quite helpful. In a book called Medical Psychotherapy, he wrote this: the existential analysis had to take the revolutionary and heretical step, not only to aim at the human power or ability to enjoy, but also to see his love and ability to suffer as a fundamentally possible and actually necessary talk. So that is what he tried in his psychotherapeutical approach. You need to learn to suffer, to put it very, very bluntly. Dear patient, can't help you by making the pain go away. You have to learn how to deal with it, how to make it productive in your life. And Ivan Illich, who I'm not sure if he was a Christian, wrote something to the effect that pain and suffering are obviously unavoidable components of a conscious confrontation with reality. They are not a sign of our need to be treated gently and considerately. And that's psychotherapy, one aspect. There are other methods, other approaches, which I, as a Christian, do not find that thrilling. So I've included that, just these indications on where psychotherapy of pain drives at. Tries to alleviate pain by making a person integrated into her life. There is also pain treatment and coping with pain socio-therapeutically, and I hope this will answer your question. What does socio-therapeutic pain treatment mean? Where does it start, and how does it go about pain? And mind you, both approaches, both the psychotherapeutic and socio-therapeutic approaches, take the concept of a person seriously. Not you are just a collection of matter, fragments, material stuff, and I just need to interfere somewhere and this pain will go away. Or you'll have to kill yourself. It will never go away. You'll have to kill yourself. I happened to find some PhD students in our department to be checking on the internet how you could kill yourself in a most mildly fashion when you are not really able to move, but you don't want any assistance. You want to do it yourself because perhaps assistance will not be granted to you for legal or ethical reasons. Still, I tried to explain to them that I don't think I know best when to end my life. Somebody else knows better than I will ever do. But that's a different topic. But it tells you that people, in a way, are taking themselves seriously as persons in this context. And that could help with people, which I rarely meet actually, that want to get rid of the concept of person and subjectivity and everything. For them, it may help to experience strong pain and try to do something about it. Many current clinical trials reveal something which could be obvious, that pain relief by care helps. You need to have people the patient relates to. You need to react unmistakably, show neither hectic nor rejection nor excessive concern when you try to help them. Not as a doctor, but just as a person for another person. You're not the medical person that tries to help with medical treatment. You have to hit the right note. The book of Job and his talks with his friends could help a lot to find the right note, both as the person that feels the pain and as the person that wants to help. You want to concord with the patient in the evaluation of his situation and pain. It doesn't help to say, well, this is much worse than you think, or, well, why are you so depressed? This is just go on with your life. All of this doesn't really help. You need to find ways to distract the patient from his pain. And this has been, Angus told me yesterday that with philosophical things, sometimes he finds he if he tries to find the right pitch with people that are laymen, as for philosophy, they would say, well, I've always known this. Why do I need philosophy to find this out? And this kind of study is a little bit like it. These studies corroborate what, as persons, we anyway would do if our feelings for others are not completely distorted. And I think this is also something where you could bring in a Christian standpoint of view, which has all these aspects integrated, just in the ethics and understanding of person and how persons cooperate, relate to each other, in especially in the New Testament. Sociotherapeutic pain treatment. I would like to quote from a 2003 study where a questionnaire, that was just a questionnaire study, not a clinical study trying to help people with pain. It was, because that is very telling, especially for us in Europe and I suppose also in the US. It was a questionnaire study with fatally ill lung cancer patients, and these patients were asked in a bit more sophisticated way, what is your biggest problem now that you are facing pain and death, and probably nothing can be done about it? People in Kenya, that was one leg of the study, said, my biggest problem is the pain. This, you know what pain is like, everybody knows it. And there were hardly any analgesics available, or too few analgesics. But these people said, I'm quite happy with my personal situation. They had a satisfactory number of friends, relatives, and because most of them, it seems, were in a church, church members to visit them, express their empathy, bring something to help with the situation, even if they didn't have analgesics. Now, the other leg of the study was performed in Europe, happened to be in Scotland, but I think it could have been anywhere in Europe. And the people said the biggest problem we have is anxiety and loneliness. That's our biggest problem. There were more than enough analgesics, but these people that were filling in the questionnaire said hardly anybody visits me, and if they come, they don't stay for a long time. I don't get any consolation. So actually, let me translate the outcome of this study in the context of this talk. We have pain amplifiers in Europe. We have a lot of painkillers, but the pain amplifiers very often are stronger. And the pain amplifiers are sociological ones and personal ones. Pain amplifiers like isolation. If you're isolated, pain will be much, much worse than when you're in a good personal setting. Distrust. Patients don't trust doctors, for example. Patients don't trust pharmaceutical companies. We have in Germany, when I give talks to lay people on drugs, usually I get some questions like, why is the pharmaceutical industry so bad? So I would usually say, we should be thankful. We are in a country with one of the best medical systems in the world. And even if you go back 100 years or 200 years in Germany, we didn't have all this medical help. So thankfulness is the first reaction we should have, rather than not trust everybody around other than yourself. And of course, we have very high expectations of personal happiness and a lot of anxiety about the future. And all these are pain amplifiers working sociologically, and they amplify, they worsen the physical and social pain. And I could go on to explain this. So the help, the pain relief that would be needed in this context is, of course, analgesics. I'm not saying that we don't need analgesic drugs. That is certainly not the case. If there is good medical help, we should thankfully accept it. But if we want to really help with this aspect of pain, and it's a strong aspect of pain, you need trust, you need fellowship, you need to have affections that work through giving and receiving. And that is not something a drug can give. That is beyond the possibilities drugs have. You're perhaps completely aware of this, but pain cannot be measured quantitatively. I could measure my blood pressure. It would be probably something like 130 to 80, but I could not measure my pain. I cannot measure your pain while you're trying to keep awake for this talk. Maybe there is some pain somewhere, but it would be hard to say I have 17 pain and you have 152 pain. There is nothing like it. And that is, of course, medically speaking, a problem. And let's say philosophically speaking or something like it, it's very interesting. There are comparative pain scale charts, because if you want to ask a kid, if you are a pediatrician, and you want to find out how bad is the pain for this kid, how much drug do I have to give him so the pain is reduced, but I don't want to give too much. They are faced with these faces, and they are supposed to say, well, this is how I feel now, that badly. And this is actually done. This is not from a textbook. This is what is done in hospitals, for example. So you cannot quantitatively measure pain. People try that. The most recent and most important scaling approach, scientifically speaking, is with functional nuclear magnetic resonance. Functional nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. Basically, what people do is they check through magnetic resonance imaging how certain parts of the brain are, how much blood you find in certain parts of the brain. And they try to analyze this on a very small scale, kind of trying to look at neuronal activation as a reflection of blood amount in small bits of the central nervous system. This was published in 2013, and this paper has aroused a lot of interest, because for doctors, of course, it would be good if they could find a quantitative measurement of pain. Although, in one of my seminars with undergraduates, we talked about this, and one of the students said, I would also welcome this. So I said, why don't you just tell the doctor how much pain you feel and communicate with the doctor? No, this is more objective. So I said, but if they just use a machine and get a reading, you're sort of alone. Whereas if you communicate with somebody that wants to help you, isn't that better? Isn't subjectivity better? Sometimes, this kind of conversation was quite interesting, I found. Well, what they do here is they try to find a neurological signature, a pattern in the brain for physical pain by measuring neurological activity. What they did was they applied short heat pulses to the skin and then recorded what happened in the brain. The problem with this is, I suppose it's basically, again, this brain-soul problem. Is what they measure pain? Is it identical? Is that the pain? Or do they measure some physiological reaction which is correlated to pain but not identical to pain? That, I think, is the question behind this. And people in other scientific papers have posed the questions, like, does the increased neurological activity in the brain areas indeed reflect the experience of pain? And does it reflect the experience of pain quantitatively, which would be important? Actually, people presently say that this does not provide a quantitative assessment of clinically relevant pain states. It works for heat pulse pain, but you cannot use this model and predict quantitatively the pain somebody feels from a completely different, for pain with a completely different reason. For that, you would have to make a new model. So at the moment, I think we are stuck with this subjectivity of pain. And what I try to explain to colleagues and students and people that are very, very convinced of science, turning it into scientism, that subjectivity is actually better in many cases. And this is a little bit like what we heard yesterday, that science cannot answer all questions, science cannot cover all aspects of life, to put it in very simple terms. So I think that sometimes you have to leave this distancing yourself, objectivity, and on the contrary, you have to try to find a relational approach to something. Knowledge by acquaintance. I think that was how you worded it yesterday. Coping with pain mentally means somehow looking inwardly. Now, finally, a few thoughts on coping with pain spiritually. That is a bit foreign to some people, because I think that coping with pain spiritually means that you're looking outward. Of course, everybody can understand that if you look outward to another human being, because we know they exist. But to look to God, trying to find help with pain, that is a different matter. And it needs this relational approach to God, which is actually what we could try, especially if we have personal experiences, knowledge by acquaintance for pain, different types of pain, which you could perhaps tell people about. What is pain? Just a quick summary, some aspects before I come to the close. Pain means, well, it's something very real. Quantitative determination is impossible. That is actually why potential analgesics that are active in animals often fail in humans. Because when a compound seems to be analgesic in an animal, very often it's not in humans, because of all this subjectivity and the filtering of the signal, or the different levels that are involved in pain, this integrative, because pain needs, I think, somebody to say this is pain, this integration. Animals, for example, are put on a hot plate, and the longer they stay on this hot plate with a compound, a substance that is supposed to be analgesic, the better this analgesic is. Of course, you have to differentiate, like I said at the beginning of my talk, between whether this is sedative or toxic, because if you start killing the animal, it will also stay put on this plate because it's just too weak, almost dying. So it's really, really difficult. There are no safe, predictive models for pain research, because pain is not like blood pressure. Intensity and evaluation are individually different, as we all know. It's subjective but real. And I find that this is also a very important thing to try to tell my students and colleagues. Look, subjective is not bad, it's real. It could feel bad, it could feel good. Very, very real. Very real, even though you can't put a number to it. Pain is always connected with pleasant or unpleasant sensations. It's connected with a sense of power or powerlessness. Of course, this would open up another aspect of pain, where people like to feel pain or like to inflict pain. This dark aspects of human nature. It's a common experience of all mankind. And as I said in the beginning, pain is central in medicine and pharmacy. But it's also central in the Christian worldview. It's not something which we have to, unfortunately, explain. It's very central. So we can start by looking at pain. It won't be painless to do that, but I think we can treat the subject in a good way. Pain is not just bad, even on a purely physical level. Pain is an important signal. It shows us, shows the body, tells the body, tells the person that, if I adopt the dualistic view, it tells the person that his body is experiencing some kind of problem. But it's also a signal that we are mortal. Of course, we cannot think about that every day of our life, all time, but it's something we have to think about, that we are mortal. This is part of being human, that you cope with the fact that I are mortal, and we do that while we are awake, fully alive. We don't wait for a situation to do that when we are too weak to do the subject of our mortality justice. Belief in God and coping with pain. I would like to finally quote from a chapter which I happened to find. This is the first chapter of a medical book. I don't think there is an English translation of the book. But the book is called Pain Treatment and Palliative Medicine. And it was published by one of the big medical books publishers in Germany. And I happened to see that the first chapter was written by this lady. The book appeared in 2012. This lady is late. It was Hildegard Teuschel, an Austrian social reformer, and she was the founder of the hospice movement in Austria. I didn't know about her before I happened upon this book chapter. And she wrote what we are going to read a few days before her death in the year 2009. And the publishers of the book decided to put this in front of the book. And here are a few sentences from her book. I've actually translated somewhat liberally because passages of what I translated are written in Austrian, in an Austrian dialect. She uses Austrian dialect to bring something across which I can understand, but I've just translated it a bit liberally. So she wrote, "How can you believe in a loving God who sends you cancer? This and similar questions I was asked many times last year. I do not have an answer to this, but one thing I know for sure, God does not send a cancer. God does not send a cancer. He gives me a new experience, something I did not know until now. A dear friend put it like this, your cancer and pain were given to you as a new task you had nothing to do with yet. I reflect and revisit what I said and wrote in my lectures on the establishment and development of hospice care. I realize that many things were correct and supportive. For example, that palliative care can alleviate or eliminate a lot of pain. I do not linger on thoughts like what is no longer possible for me now. But I thank God that I had a fulfilled life. I'm glad to realize that my personal relationship with God sustains me and that I have not slipped into a depression yet. I deeply trust that God will not leave me alone in the last period of my life. I made a very special experience when my brother died. I was looking for a quote that could be consoling for him. And this sentence in the Gospel of Mark caught my attention. When Jesus saw their confidence, he said to the paralytic, 'Son, your sins are forgiven.'" This is just a few sentences from, I hope many medical doctors will read as a chapter. I was asked by the bioscience students in my faculty a few years ago to do a talk on ethics as a scientist, and they knew I was a Christian. And it was about 200 or 300 students. And they also said, look, when we ask for such an extra lecture, we also like to do an excursion. Usually it's something we go to a company and look at how some drug is being produced. For this topic of bioethics, for us as bioscience students, do you have a suggestion? So at first I didn't. But when I thought about it, I had two suggestions for them. One, try to join the public part of an ethics committee meeting of the hospital. The ethics committee has to approve of all clinical studies. Secondly, visit a hospice, because there you will see the limits of science very clearly. The limit of science. You will see the limit of science, but not the limit of humanity, of being human. That's what you will see there. But they didn't go. They didn't. we have a hospice in one of the hospitals in the place where I live. So the Christian perspective of pain is not like avoid it at all costs. Avoid it, yes, but not at all costs. Not at all costs. Don't treat it as an illusion, like I understand some people in Hinduism and Buddhism try to do. It's just an illusion. You have to close your mind to it. No, it's not an illusion. It's very real. What you feel is real, and it hurts. And it would hurt me if I had it. Do not regard it as lost lifetime. which is actually part of what any psychotherapy and social therapy also try. This is not against modern medical science. To try to think about pain in the following terms. Try to connect pain with the following terms. Compassion. Because as a Christian, I can tell you from my experience as a Christian, from what I understand, think I know about God, that God has experienced pain not from the outside, but from a human perspective. For him, it's not foreign. He knows compassion. Would that perhaps help? Try to connect pain, not with I want to get away, but with endurance, such an important human virtue, endurance. And even God, you know, he, from my Christian understanding of God, I could talk more about this if you like to, God being man was made perfect through suffering. So he wanted to experience this. It was, even for God, something that added to his fullness. Try to think about it in terms of hope. There will be a new creation. Well, that's perhaps hard to believe, but let's have a look at it, because it's so good as an option. It's so good. There will be no pain, neither for God nor for creatures. That is connecting pain with hope. The light at the end of the tunnel, you know, is God, who has gone through the tunnel himself. So I've skipped the Bonhoeffer quotations, which you will find on the handouts. I don't want to go into them. Sort of apologetically speaking, finally, I try to put reason, beauty, and pain as, propose reason, beauty, and pain and other related terms as factors for faith categories. They're all realities. Realities like the mathematical descriptiveness of the universe and its beauty, which will be the topic of Andy's talk this afternoon, right? Is it today? Yeah. Today. Fine-tuning in cosmology, physics, chemistry, and biology. That's a difficult topic to talk to with biologists, that there is fine-tuning, pointing to a designer, perhaps. Evidence for design, the obvious creativity, those are realities, but a very obvious thing, but it's not that present in apologetics at the moment, as far as I can see. There is this other reality, which is also important, and a good explanation needs to cover both aspects, the wildness, the bloodiness, the pain and everything in the universe, at least on the Earth. The universe is really a bit too big, but we can feel the depths of pain. It's very deep, but that is accessible to us subjectively. So a good explanation of the world will cover both aspects. Somehow. Thank you for your attention.